Messiah, Jesus, the King, is returning. He will return. Every eye will see. Every knee will bow. Every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. The day is approaching. The day is coming. So, until that time, how shall we live? The King will appear. How shall the King's people wait for him? How shall we wait? What is the posture of our waiting in the anticipation of the appearance of our great and glorious King? These are some of the things I want to address from this passage in the 15th chapter of the book of Judges with you tonight. Let me just say something by way of introduction just on this book, the Judges, the book of Judges. Perhaps you'll be familiar that although it tells of a narrative of events taking place over a 400-year period, there are other portions of the scriptures that speak about events happening at the same time. And perhaps in the forefront of your mind, you might think of the book of Ruth, for it says in Ruth that these things took place in the time of the Judges. Perhaps a little less understood is that the first and opening portions of the first book of Samuel also take place at the same time as these events that we've just been reading about concerning Samson. So, just to refresh your minds as far as 1 Samuel goes and the opening of 1 Samuel, you remember perhaps that there was a high priest by the name of Eli, who administered at the tabernacle at that time, and the Ark of the Covenant resided there. And he had these two very indisciplined and corrupt sons who he failed to rein in. And at that time, the Philistines appeared in Israel on the land, particularly in the south, the land of Judah. And the Philistines were a very capable people. Many people think they're an offshoot of the people that we come to know as the Greeks, the Mycenaeans, great seafaring people, ambitious, adventurous people, not fools and not lacking courage either. And they made an inroad into the land, and they established themselves in five cities in the south in the land, which was Judah, and they turned it into Philistia. And they made advances, progressive advances, up into the hill country where the children of Israel had their dwelling places. And so, in consequence, Eli and his sons and the other people of Israel determined that they should check this advance and raise an army. They wanted to push the Philistines back into the sea where they belonged, out of their land, out of their territory. And in their folly, in their foolishness, the counsel was taken that they should take the Ark of the Covenant, the most sacred artifact in the centre of the cultus that God had given through Moses, take it out of the temple, which in itself is a preposterous idea in the first instance, and they should have known better than to do so. They took the Ark of the Covenant and they took the Ark into battle. They took it into battle against the Philistines. You've heard when you've got a problem and you've thrown everything you can at it. You throw everything, even the kitchen sink. You've done everything you possibly can to check the advance of a problem. They did everything they thought they could do to stop the Philistines advancing. And you know perhaps what happened. The Philistines routed Israel's armies. Eli's sons were killed in the battle. Eli, on hearing that his sons were dead, and the Ark of the Covenant was captive and been taken captive by the Philistines back to their temple, the temple of their god Dagon. Eli, hearing this, fell off his chair and broke his neck and was dead. Now, these events that I'm relating to you were happening in the days of Samson. They're not in the foreground of the narrative that we read in the book of Judges, but these things were happening in the background. But there is something else we ought to say that happened at those times, which relates, I think, more closely to what we read about this man, Samson, this remarkable man who God raised up as a judge, Samson. And that is this, that though Israel was utterly defeated and destroyed, and we read in chapter 15, verse 4, in the passage we have before us, that the ascendancy and the power was granted to the Philistines. The Philistines ruled the whole land. All the Israelites paid their tributes to the Philistines. Even though that was true, the Ark of the Covenant itself, standing in the temple of Dagon, you've perhaps read the story yourself, the statue to their god, every morning they came into the temple, was found face down in front of the Ark of the Covenant. And gradually the people of the Philistines started to grow sick. And something started to disquiet the people of the Philistines to such an extent they realized that they had to give this Ark of the Covenant back. They needed it off their land. The Lord himself, I suppose, is what I'm saying to you. That in the absence of the power of God's people to rescue and bring back the Ark to its rightful place, God himself fetched it and brought it back to the land. The Philistines put the Ark of the Covenant on the back of a cart, and they tethered the cart to oxen, and they must have just given the oxen a stick, and off they went in whatever direction they say choose. It came to reside just 3 miles from where Samson grew up, in Kiriath Jearim. Now, anything that happens in a radius of about 3 miles is not something that happens in a corner. This is not a secret thing. Samson and everybody in the nation knew what God had done, how he brought his glory back to his people. God did it, not them. God did it. God was at work in Israel. In those dark days of Philistine oppression, God himself in his sovereign power is at work. And more than that, in the very same tabernacle where Eli and his sons, his indisciplined sons, had been ministering, a small boy had been born to a barren woman. And that boy, named Samuel, had been given into that tabernacle and been raised up. And this man was a prophet. This was a man who heard God speaking to him and spoke the very living words of God. And perhaps you know your Bibles well enough to know that the destiny that God had for Samuel is Samuel would be the man who would see God's king. He would identify of all the children of Jesse, this young man, this David. And David's great glory was he defeated the Philistines. Samuel saw that. And at the same time that God supernaturally was granting this barren woman a child who would be a prophet, who would usher in the beginning of the kingdom for Israel, at the same time he was also raising up from a barren woman this man, Samson. And we read of Samson's ministry that what David would finish in the defeat of the Philistines, Samson would begin. In chapter 13 and verse 5, we read that Samson's ministry, his purpose was to begin to throw off the yoke of the Philistines from the children of Israel. The king would finish it, but Samson was called to start it. That is the point that I'm trying to make. So here at the beginning of this chapter, we can see these are dark days for Israel. Verse 4 tells us the Philistines were firmly in charge of the land, but God was at work. Maybe you feel sometimes as Christians that these are dark days. Maybe you feel that we're living in times of oppression. Maybe you feel the gospel doesn't seem to have much liberty or power in the nation. Maybe you think the glory of God is hidden. But I think you're not ignorant either that God is at work. There are people coming to faith. The church is growing. There are people who are at prayer. There are people standing up on the street corners and speaking about Jesus. The gospel of Jesus Christ is not bound. God is at work even in these dark days. Jesus is coming. Jesus will return. The king will appear. And though it may be dark days in the days leading up to his appearing, there is work for you and me to do in anticipation of his appearing. We're not to be waiting passively for the day of his coming to quell all enemies. We're to get up as Samson got up and get out there and begin. Find yourself in the work. That's the place to be found when the king appears, serving him in the battle, not waiting for his appearing behind your fortification walls. So that's the substance of what I have to say to you tonight. Samson, this great judge whom God granted to Israel. If you look at the beginning of the passage there, in chapter 13 and verse 25, just before the passage begins, we're given some geographical details about where it was that Samson was living, a place called Mahaneh Dan. And the archaeologists tell us that it was a small mound with a fortification on the top. And there some of the tribe of Dan had encamped themselves in a small hill fort. And looking on a map, if you had one, you might find the place and you'd realise that This little place in between Zora and Eshtaol, which we read about in chapter 13, verse 25, is absolutely on the border between two portions of land. With the geographical character is very different. Behind this town is the mountains, the hills, the foothills. I don't know if any of you have been to the Holy Land, if you've been to Israel, but you'll know that it's a high ground, the mountains of Judah. And they in themselves are something of a defence, and you can live there relatively unmolested because high ground is harder to capture, isn't it? And so the children of Israel, broadly speaking, were living in this high ground, and Samson was right at the frontier of that land. And on the other side was the plains, the open plains going down to the sea, which was the land of Judah, and that was the best of the land. We've got a reference here how there were vineyards in that land. I don't know if you picked it up during the reading. It was a wonderful place where grapes grow, it's fertile, and there's wheat and barley. But the Philistines had that land. The best of the land was in the hands of the Philistines. And the hard, tough land, the rugged land, was in the hands of the Israelites. And here is Samson growing up on the border between these two portions of land. And he has choices to make about what kind of a life he's going to live. He has the opportunities of interaction and interface with the Philistines who are on one side of him. Or he can find himself interacting and identifying himself more fully with the Israelites who live at the back of him, as it were. And there's very clear evidence here, as we've read before, that the Philistines are the people in charge. They are controlling the land, and the people of Israel are paying their tributes to them. This is a time of oppression. But did you notice in chapter 14 that this border between these two peoples is seemingly a very relaxed border? Did you notice that he's able to seemingly walk down the road to Timnah? Timnah is a Philistine town. He was able just to stroll down and stroll into town, and seemingly nobody molested him, and his parents are able to go for a walk, and they can go down to Timnah too. There's a very relaxed atmosphere between the Israelites and the Philistines. And that happens, doesn't it, when a powerful people are dominating the land. Maybe in the Roman times, people just accepted they have such power. You just kind of rub along. You just accept that these people are in charge, and we're lesser people, and we give them our tributes, and that's the way we live. Perhaps if you'd lived in one of the occupied countries in Europe during the Second World War, you might have come to a point where you just accepted that there are these people, and they're people like we do, and we sit and have a drink together, and we talk, and we socialise together, and we have a very relaxed arrangement with each other. But we know our place. Here's the people who are in charge. And here are the people who are subservient. Perhaps if you've grown up in the South, in the United States of America, and you're a person of colour, perhaps you would have known what it was to be able to live in a society where you understood where your boundaries were. You live here, and they live there, and they live in these houses, and we live in these houses, and that's just how it is. That's how life is lived by people. We just accept that we're under their yoke, and we have to give them tribute. This is the kind of situation that we see Samson growing up in. You know, we can go into their towns and they can come into our towns, but we know our place and they know their place. And there's a status quo. But Samson is called to throw off that yoke. Samson is called to say no to that status quo. Samson is called to upset that balance. We love a peaceful life, don't we? People love a peaceful life. I think in the American Declaration of Independence, it talks about how people are want to put up with grievous sufferings rather than change. But at a certain point, the status quo is unacceptable. It is not just, it is not right, it's not edifying, it's not glorifying to God, and there must be change. And something starts to stir. Something starts to stir in this one person, Samson. Nobody else wanted to upset the balance. Did you notice the way his parents talked to him? Oh, they've taught him so well. We just stay amongst our people. We do our thing. Don't upset the status quo. But there's something on the inside of Samson that says no. And you need to listen to that voice in you. Because indeed, as it was in Samson, it was the very voice of God saying, no, there must be change. The land of Judah belonged to his people. They were interlopers, invaders. They did not belong there. It was not theirs. And Samson could not swallow it. You know, people rubble on, they accept all manner of problems, just sitting there on their life, sitting there week in, week out, month in, month out. A sort of arrangement, they can't become comfortable with the status quo. And yet it seems that the Spirit of the Lord stirred up this person to say, no, no more. Everything must change. Now, is this just because Samson was one of those people? Have you met people that just kind of like to create trouble? I had a friend at school. I couldn't walk more than a few hundred yards without getting into trouble if I spent time with this guy. There was something about him. He invited trouble. He was a magnet for trouble. If you spent time with him, you ended up in trouble. And people have discredited Samson. They've said all manner of things about Samson as if he himself, it was his character, the weakness of his character. But look what it says in chapter 13, verse 25. Who's stirring up this man? It's God. God is stirring up Samson. This disquiet, this dissatisfaction, this holy dis-ease is being stirred up in him by God. Now people say all things about Samson, but we should at least stop and address that single point. And the language there of stirring up there, when you translate it, is similar in its grammatical construction to the kind of language we read about in Jesus' account of how he was driven out by the Spirit into the wilderness. Who did he meet out in the wilderness? He met his enemy in the wilderness. And Samson is stirred up. And what does Samson do? He goes out to meet his enemy on his enemy's turf. He doesn't stay home within the stockade fence on his little hill on the borderland of his people. He leaves and he goes out, as it were, into the wilderness of the Philistine community. And he goes there to meet his enemy face to face, as Jesus does. He doesn't stay home drinking wine, and there must have been plenty of wine to be drunk. But when the cup came round, Samson said, no, no, I am not accepting the status quo. Samson's journey to Timnah looks like a mission of peace. It's a declaration of war. He is on the offensive. He is attacking his neighbours and looking for opportunity to start a fight. His name, Samson, derives from the Hebrew word Shemesh, which is the name for the sun. And there is something in the way this is constructed that suggests it's like the darkness is beginning to break. The light is beginning to shine. It's like a sunrise. Suddenly, the Spirit of the Lord is rising. God is moving in his people. And they will not just allow the status quo to remain as it is. And Samson's there at the front. The sunrise is coming. He's a man. He's just a man. He's just flesh and blood like you or like me, no different to any of us. But you see, in the power that is demonstrated in his actions, God is with Samson. God stirs him up and God is with him. God's power is at work. And as he leaves for Timnah, as he sets out on his journey for Timnah, he meets his first challenge. He meets the lion, doesn't he, on that road. What would you do if you met a lion on the road to Timnah? And I think in his natural self, in his flesh, he would do what most of us would do. He would understand that he's facing an enemy he cannot overcome and take the wise course and run. But he doesn't. He says, no. He tears that lion. He tears it apart as if it was a young goat. Is this his physical strength at work? It's God. It's a sign that in going to Timnah, God is with him as he goes. He meets God. And that lion is in Judah. The lion of Judah is smitten by God. Something is going on. And for Christians, we might begin to prick up our ears and see there's something of Christ here. Something is at work here. And out of the side of the lion of Judah comes this honey, this sweetness, this strength, this sustaining energy that Samson, who goes hungry out into the wilderness, is fed. He meets God. Not just in the smiting of the lion of the tribe of Judah, but also of the sweetness that comes from his side. Enough for him, enough for his mother, enough for his father. Comfort coming to God's people. The beginning of a victory after time and time and time and time again living defeated. Living under the pall of defeat all their lives. But now in the carcass of that lion, victory. God is showing himself strong for his people. What's he doing as he goes? He is tasting and he is seeing that the Lord is good. As he goes, he is meeting with God, who shuts the lion's mouth on his behalf and gives him strength. Good, for the first time, is coming out of evil. As he goes, what am I saying to you here? It doesn't matter how many times we've been defeated. It doesn't matter how serious or heavy the oppression may seem. Go. Go to Timnah. Meet your God on the road, on the way. Don't wait. The king will appear, but we are to begin what he will finish. No truce with the devil. There can be no truce with the devil. Now some people will say, Timnah, really? Timnah? To go down to one of the daughters of the Philistines? Really? Is this the plan of God? It is indeed a riddle and a puzzling move. And you perhaps will join with the voices of reason that are heard. In verse 3, you see his parents speaking to him, pleading with him to be more sensible, to be more reasonable, to be more balanced in his judgment, to settle down, to live a quiet life. Don't make trouble. Don't stir things up. Abide by the status quo. But Samson says no. And when the lion comes at him, everything inside him must surely have been screaming out, take the wise course, take the wise road, run. But something in him says no. And in it he meets God. We know that from birth he was forbidden from eating of the fruit of the vine. And how many times must the glass of sherry come round, the best of wines in his air? No, no. No, Samson learned from his youth to say no. And in every time he said no, he was saying yes to God. I am consecrated to him. I am his servant. Self-denial, the growing out of his hair. Hot and sticky and in his eyes. And you know, in Israel, according to all the customs, it was a shameful thing for a man to have long hair. And no disrespect to any of the women here, but in that culture, you look like a girl. You look like a girl. How many times must he have been tempted to go down to the barbershop and get a haircut just like everybody else? Don't you want to fit in? So many people just want to fit in. But every time that temptation came to fit in, he remembered God and said no. And let his hair grow. Daring to be different. Upsetting the status quo, not accepting the balance, knowing that God was at work and wanting to meet him. You know, self-denial is essential to our consecration to God. We have to learn to say no. And in saying no, we are saying yes to something far greater, to our calling. Our calling and invitation to get into the spiritual conflict, to engage, to fight the good fight, to stand for the gospel, for the coming king. Why did Samson love this girl? What was it about her? Verse 3. Why did he settle his affections on her? Of all the girls in the world, surely this is the most unsuitable partner. Did he think that this woman would make for him a good, faithful, and loving wife? Not for a minute. Not for a minute. He knows perfectly well who this girl is. There is one reason and one reason alone why she is the perfect choice. And it's because she will betray him. That fundamentally, the antipathy between her people and his means it is absolutely certain that given the right circumstances, she will cash in her cards, and for 30 pieces of silver or whatever it might be, she will betray him. And he needs to be betrayed. For it's in being betrayed that he is sucked deeper and deeper inside the heart of the Philistine society where he will do his greatest works. In short, this woman is perfect because she is his Judas. The one who must be betrayed. It's by this betrayal that the salvation that he is called to bring will come about. And what is necessary for that is an excuse. This betrayal is the perfect excuse to break out the fighting, to break the truce, to break the peace. It says there in verse 4, it says there, it was the Lord. The Lord was behind this plan. Now, is it the Lord's will that Jews should marry the daughters of their neighbours who worship other gods? You know your Bibles well enough to say that isn't true. Just as much as you know today that it is not in God's plan that we should marry those who are not of the household of faith. And so, under this great new covenant, Jews and Gentiles may marry if they are in the Lord. But surely God is not commissioning Samson to do that which is hostile to his own will. No, he is sending Samson to her because he knows that she will betray him, and through that betrayal will come the opportunity that he is looking for. To start the fight, to break the truce, to change the balance of power. God wants to change the world, you know. Hebrews chapter 11 says of Samson, lest we forget, that he is a hero of the faith. The people who are drawn into this trap are the Philistines, who, when he throws a feast, you know, the whole plan was to throw a feast, and then they said they add 30 extra guests. I don't know if any of you have ever paid for a wedding, but if you've made wedding plans and the other side of the family have just multiplied the number of people they're invited by 30, and they expect you to foot the bill, you know they are pushing and pushing and pushing and showing who's in charge. Humiliating. That's their purpose. That's their plan. And God wills that they should do that, to overplay their hand so that his opportunity might be opened so Samson can strike back and it be just. And when he strikes, it is just. He has cause. As you answer God's call, as you go to your Timnah, as you go out from the comfort and security of your ring-fenced world and go out into all the world and make disciples of all nations, you will see and meet God. You will see what he can do, how he can turn the oppressor into the oppressed and the predator into the prey. See what God will do. There are so many similarities in the life of Samson to things that pertain to Christ. It's quite remarkable. It's like Christ has got his fingerprints all over his life. Even at his birth, the announcement, the annunciation of his birth, there's something of Christ in that. The way the Spirit stirs him up, there's something of Christ in that. The way he goes to be betrayed, there's something of Christ in that. The fact that the angel of the Lord appears and his parents live, the only person of the Trinity that you can see and live is Christ. And when that angel disappears again, he is ascended into heaven, even as Christ was ascended. Christ seems to have his fingerprints all over Samson's life. Can people see Christ in your life? In the choices that you make, the things that you say no to, the bold steps you take to upset the balance, to refuse to accept the status quo that this world imposes upon us and God says no to. We need to activate the border, as Samson activated the border. In verse 19, the quiet and peaceful and relaxed border that existed at the beginning of the passage is gone. What we have is angry people, stirred up Philistines, stirred up Samson. The truce has been broken. Let me tell you, the spiritual conflict is something Christ is calling his people into. Are you answering? Finally and briefly, it says in the book of Deuteronomy that one shall put 1,000 to flight and two shall put 10,000 to flight. I don't know what you think you on your own can do. I don't know what you think, what difference you can make. But this passage tells us that you could do something remarkable. Perhaps more can happen than you reasonably think or expect. God is able to do exceedingly abundantly above and beyond all we ask or expect or think, you know. Can one person bring change? The story of Samson says, oh yes. And if you're not sure, ask the lion. And if you're not sure, ask the bees who lost their honey. And if you're not sure, ask the Philistines who lost their clothes. If you're not sure, look at the life of Jesus and see what one person can do. If you'll heed the voice of the Lord and say no to the voice of the world and meet God as you go to your Timnah and see what he will do. God has chosen to change the world through people in obedience to him. It says in the book of Acts, these people have turned the world upside down. Of Christians, ordinary Christians, trusting God and going. Maybe you think Samson was a special person, a special case, and certainly his life was promised. He was a child of promise. It's a bee. No, it's not.
I wish that would have been good, wouldn't it? It's a wasp. I think the Spirit of the Lord might come upon me in a moment. Dispatch him. Let me just remind you that you may think that this is something that just applies to special people. But the book of Galatians says that you are the children of promise. You are children that were prophesied in times gone by. God spoke about you before you were even born. He had you in mind. He has plans for your life. You're not ordinary people. You're a peculiar people. You're God's people. And you need to remember that. And this is the mystery, and this is the riddle, really, of what we're reading about in this passage here. Is that Samson, it's a big wasp, isn't it?
It's a queen.
Samson, he doesn't look strong, He really doesn't. I sometimes you see the drawings in the Sunday school books. I don't know what you see in your Sunday school books, but he's a big guy with big hair and stuff like that. He's not strong in himself. There's nothing about him particularly that commends us as a strong man. His strength is simple. It's in his trust in God, who is great and powerful and mighty. Isn't it a mystery and a wonder that it's our weakness that is the means by which God's strength is displayed and shown? And the truth is that if somebody told you that that was God's plan to use weak and foolish people for his glory and honour, you wouldn't believe it. But just like the Philistines had to be told the riddle, so we have to be told the mystery of God's will for our life. That though we are weak, though we are small as a people, as we go in faith, he will glorify himself as strong on our behalf. So to conclude, the gospel that we're called to is a gospel of offence. We're supposed to be on the offensive. And the Greek word that's used for offence is scandalos. There's something scandalous about the cross. It's offensive. Galatians chapter 5 verse 11. The scandal of the cross. The offence of the cross. And that's what we're going in. That's the strength that we go in. Christ's weakness and betrayal, the means by which our salvation is wrought, and the power of God glorified in the resurrection of him who entrusted himself to God completely and did not sin. Christ's weakness is our strength. Is it your strength? If it's your strength, go. In the name of Jesus, go to Timnah and do his bidding. Because this is the final thing I have to say, isn't it? The king is coming. And Samson chose to be found in the battle, not in the fort. When Christ comes, he is looking for faith on the earth. Will he find you in the battle? Or in the fort. Let's sing something to close. 360. This hymn, obviously written in a time of great spiritual conflict. The Reformation, Luther. And when we sing it, sometimes I think we exaggerate in our own mind the degree of our sufferings and identify with them whose sufferings were far greater than ours. But if we will go, we might find these words more true to us than they presently are. Let's sing it in faith. A safe stronghold, our God is still.